soon.
Okay, cool. All right, awesome. I did not know I was going to talk to this many people in Kentucky for a week. Or that this was going to be a thing. But the volunteers here were on fire for this in a way I've not seen other groups of people in other places where you have far many more museums and far more people into museum and living history work. So I've been very impressed. Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, I couldn't eat for like 2 days, which is rare for me. And I went up to New York and had the opportunity to be in a room with wonderful people and the best people in my field, I guess. That's the way to put it. And so they announced, you got the best writing award for the year. Great. Then I ate my little salmon, whatever. Had my little glass of wine. Thought I was cool. Then at the end, my friend Scott Alves Barden got up. He was a board member. And I'm like, why is Scott up there? And then next thing I know, he says something about Michelle Obama talking about being in a house built by the enslaved. And I said, that's a really odd quote to make before you talk about the book of the year. And then came in his book, at this point I'm freaking out, y'all. Because like, which one of the other his is in the room? Because, you know, there's only 10 of us. Which one of the other his is in the room could it be? And then it was book of the year. My friend and colleague Eduardo Jordan and I are the two most decorated African Americans in the history, in the 30-plus year history of the James Beard Awards. And yeah, it's something. So, and I tell you that because I was in this community when I was finishing editing and writing that book, and I was reminded by Michael at the JCC what I said when I was here in May of last year. It's been about a year, so. And he reminded the audience that I got up. I must have been really, like, upset about something. Because I got up there and I put a little fire in my sermon. And I said, I recounted how when I first introduced the idea of this book to publishers, they were excited to have a new author of color, especially an author of color who was male, but they didn't want me to be gay or Jewish. I had to be in my bubble. And if I could not be in the bubble, then I wasn't worth listening to because I was too complicated, I was too much. I wasn't America ready. And I'm like, do you understand? My people have been here 400 years. My America was here before your America was here. So please don't tell me what America is. So I must have been real mad because I said the words on that stage in Louisville. I said, just wait till I bring home them James Beard Awards. And the point isn't the award, because the award is, once you've finished writing, you know, forever, the award is just finishing the book. And being able to say you didn't default on the contract, that's the award. But the bigger thing is not allowing people to determine your life journey, not allowing people to determine and define you against your will. That essentially is what my ancestors fought against every day of their lives. So why am I going to accept less? So that's that. If you need a pick-me-up today, that's what you got. So I have, see, ding, social media saves you. So if you are a social media person and you have your handy-dandy smartphone, turn it right on back on and start tweeting, start Facebook. That's how I got here. I didn't get it by saying, oh, there's a really lovely message about some slavery and some food. No, I got here because people took the time to spread the word. And by the way, I'm not, after a week in Kentucky, I ain't shy. Look, black folks in the audience, I'm talking to you. Look at me, give me that side eye, eyeball. My brother, my sister, I'm talking to you. Nigeria did a number on my accent. Look, you heard what Brian said. We need to bring our community into the fold of museum visiting, interaction with institutions that deal with our history more. We get our churches, our reunions, whatever, because we have to keep institutions that deal with the history of slavery and the Underground Railroad honest. Because without them, there's no use complaining. Because remember, teachers come here. Students come here. We are not doing this just for our edification, but for an entire community, black, white, and otherwise. So there was one museum thing floating around Facebook. I don't know where it was. God help them when I find them. Because they had this thing about black eyed peas in the South, and they said, very proudly, black eyed peas came into the Southern diet when Confederate soldiers, I said, oh Lord, there it goes. They did what? Confederate soldiers were really hungry, so they decided to eat the black eyed peas out of the field that were meant for the livestock. And ever since then, Southerners have been eating black eyed peas. Now, yeah. Really? Wow. That's interesting. That's counterintuitive to all the documentation. Excuse me, that's counterintuitive to me going to West Africa and seeing black eyed peas in every single country I was in. Like every day, every meal. Are you kidding me? So it's that little thing right there. I just want you to analyze that comment. First of all, they make the primary actor who? The Confederate soldier. As if that is the epitome of being Southern. Number two, they make males the primary actor when males were not doing most of the cooking or agriculture, garden farming. Three, they make white folks the primary actors in what was an African crop brought to America via the slave trade, cultivated and harvested by the enslaved and free people of color. Four, they're cutting out the entire story of the African diaspora and the Atlantic world, the Afro-Atlantic, in which black-eyed peas are not just found here, but in the West Indies, in Brazil, and other places that tell a common story of a common people. So all that. And then dating it to the Civil War means we still in that cold Civil War mindset and mentality. Now, I mean, where we're still not over it. See, all that stuff in that one little paragraph, that's why it's important to bring our kinfolk. And when, so you hear people say, I don't want to go to no plantation. I'll never go to a plantation. Okay. Then say hello to amnesia. Say hello to forgetting. Say hello to, I'm telling you something, when I first set foot on plantations and did this work in urban sites related to slavery, there was something about it that was spiritual, that was deep. And that's when you go and you go in there and you know them ancestors are waiting for you. They're waiting for you. They're like, why don't they remember us? Why are they forgetting us? You know, in Africa, nobody does that. In West Africa, everybody knows where your ancestors are buried. And it was the most profound thing I ever saw. Was we went out into one of the parks in Senegal. And there was a tree that was marked off. You couldn't go near the tree. You could look at the tree, but you couldn't go near it. Because the tree was the grave of the griots, or the storytellers, of the bards, the people who remembered the culture. And it was from a time when they used to bury the griots in the tree because the tree was a symbol of life. And so if you're from one of those families, you're allowed to go to those trees, pay homage to your ancestors, and go home. But in our culture, our real culture, we honor our ancestors. Too often, our ancestors are under asphalt, under golf courses. They're under luxury condos and apartments. And nobody knows why, where they are, what's going on. We've forgotten them enough. But I promise you, when they see you walk up that lane, good things happen. When your children learn their history, good things happen. Blessings happen. And so that's my personal discussion with my family. Now, my other family, this is also for you. I just want to make sure my folks heard me. Because, you know, I get attacked on Twitter every week about why you want to be some damn slave? Why you want to wear those clothes? Why do you want to talk about that? Why do you want to be that way? As if I'm cosplaying slavery, which would really be dumb. Like, the dumbest thing ever. Like, that may work for Ben Carson, but not for me. Shade is real. And there's more of it. Just like the lovely locusts outside. And the magnolias, too. So, who knows where that is? Yes, in Senegal, in Gorée Island. And it's actually one of what were 20-something. Everybody thinks you go to that one little place. No, there were 20 of these. On Gorée Island. When you were in Senegal, which was the home of 60% of the enslaved Africans brought to Maryland and Northern Virginia, and those folks who were not retained in the Chesapeake would eventually be brought here. That's where they originated. So a lot of the Kentucky families were from those parts of Maryland and Virginia that were worn out by tobacco, that there were these robber baron planters who basically bought up everything. Huge tracts of land. That's why some of the counties you see in that area are so huge, because there were land holdings, like Loudoun and Fairfax. These were the Lord Fairfax, Lord Loudoun, and they owned, it's like ridiculous, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 acres each. So there was no, and they gave them to their children. So essentially, slaveholders packed up, brought enslaved people, and also free people of color, westward. And that's how Kentucky, Tennessee, the southern Midwest, over to Missouri, got settled by human beings who were not indigenous. We always have to remember indigenous people. We treat our history as if there was nothing there. And that was somebody's country, all of it. So in recognizing that, we also have to recognize where people came from. See, the old way of looking at our history went like this. We said the word Africa. Africa is a really big place. Africa is a huge place with incredibly diverse cultures. Africa has more linguistic diversity than any other place on Earth. I wonder why. It's because it's where people come from. Humanity comes from. It makes sense. The place of origin is also the place of greatest diversity. So, having said that, notice the seawall. You didn't have that 3 years ago. So don't tell me our world isn't changing. You could go up to the water. Now you can't because the water would come into and engulf the space. But this was my first visit to a space where enslaved Africans left. So I had been in America my whole life. I'd gone to England, gone to Liverpool, been in London, seen where the ships left, seen where they were constructed. Had a very profound spiritual moment in a Holiday Inn in Liverpool. The Holiday Inn in Liverpool on Albert Dock was a warehouse. And all it's a brick. And I was like, this is really weird. And so I'm walking through, you know, Liverpoolians have this, like, you know, Tolkien way of speaking. And they're not like Londoners. You know, the young lady at the counter said, I said, what did y'all have in here? This is weird. This building's all brick, these long halls that if they didn't put as many lights, they would be pitch dark. I said, what's happening here? I said it was used for spices and other things. I said, okay, spices. So when I went and talked to my brother man at the Museum of Slavery, the National Slave Trade, which is getting bigger in Liverpool, because you know the British embrace the idea of, we got to work through this so we can get over it. So he said to me, oh, no, there wasn't no spices up in there. He said, where you're staying is where they made the chains. That's why you have that feeling. I had this awful feeling every time I was in that building. He said, that's where the molasses and the rum was kept. Yeah. He said, you're on to something. So this was Africa. And I remember going, you always, wherever you go in these slave castles, you feel the energy the strongest where you would have been the most vulnerable. So for me, it was the dungeon for the men. And I sat on the floor, and they told me, you realize that the line on the wall is where we had to excavate the floor. And I said, well, what was here? They said, we had to excavate 2 feet of compacted feces. And you can't handle it. Use this dart, the tears, everything, you can't handle it. And I realized I didn't understand. I didn't have enough, there wasn't enough gratitude in that ocean to write, you know, to turn to ink. There wasn't enough land to turn to paper to see how grateful and how thankful I was that somebody decided to stay alive. So that not just one, but hundreds of people, so that I could be here telling you this. So I'm going to, like, skip through a couple of these, my usual suspects. He's handsome. Girl, I took that picture, and I'm like, oh. So. But in 2011, I spoke to my then partner and said, I really want to go on a trip through the entire South, and I really want to find out where we came from, and I really want to find out all these answers. I said, I have this rough idea, because I would have told you, oh, yeah, we're from Alabama, we're from Virginia, we're from North Carolina, we're from South Carolina, we're from Georgia, we're from Tennessee, blah, 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 and they were enslaved, and I know a couple of names, and I can always go to my family tree if I want to. Well, you know what happens. You start to forget, people start to leave the planet, and memories start to slide. And also, there's a ton more to learn. That was why I was so tired of watching people go on TV and get their little book flipped. You know what I'm talking about. Oh, and here we got all the answers. This is where you came from, and this is the whole story, and here's a book. Well, I didn't have nobody doing a book for me. So I decided to go on a journey. Well, you have to raise money for that. That doesn't just fall into your lap. So we raised money on crowdfunding. We made our goal. I remember the feeling of knowing that the last morning of the campaign, someone sent in the last $1,300 we needed in one fell swoop. I'm sweating bullets, right? Because you know, if you don't make it, you get a little bit of the money, but you don't get all of it. But we made over our goal. And it's one of those moments where you realize your life has changed. And this is going to keep changing. So I made a point to go to different living history sites and plantation sites like this one and to cook in them. And by example, give to those communities a taste of not only what were people doing in those local communities, but also trying to encourage them to understand and respect those sites, those kitchens as places of cultural memory. So this is my favorite kitchen at the Randolph House in Colonial Williamsburg. And I spent a year there last year. I've cooked in it many times before. I was there just last weekend hanging out. And I really want you to kind of like walk into the mind of an enslaved cook. Because first of all, these were not pushovers. These were not people who, you know, they weren't the people from Gone with the Wind. They were some of the most strong-willed, proud, creative human beings in the plantation community and in urban households. And they were some of the most important people because they were the ones in whose hands was crafted an entire cuisine that was to create a billion-dollar industry called Southern food. And they did it with a paucity of materials. They did it with limited means. They did it under oppressive laws that they could not control. And they did something even greater. Everybody in this room, every single one of you, comes from an enslaved person. Multiple enslaved people. It doesn't matter what your phenotype is, what your face looks like. Every single one of you has an ancestor who was under someone else's paw, not just for their life, but for generations. But the difference is, those of us in this room of African descent are the one group who, whenever and wherever they were enslaved, took over. Let me give you a little story. See, once upon a time, you know, Satan and the Lord had a conversation by phone. The Lord called Satan. He said, "You know what, devil? I got a problem." He said, "Now that we've integrated heaven, all the black folks are here, and I can't get a whit of sleep. Every morning, every night, they keep praising my name, shouting and hollering, rolling around. They're getting barbecue sauce and grease on their robes. They just can't, and when they preach, they just preach on forever. They just never shut up." Devil said, "Lord, I'm going to have to call you back." When the devil picked up the phone 15 minutes later, he said, "Lord, I'm going to have to call you back because the black folks just installed air conditioning." There's a motto in that story, y'all. This food thing I'm talking about is us installing the air conditioning. Our music, our religion, our dance, our everything, our aesthetic presence, our language, the fact that our kids get told stop speaking slang, and yet African-American vernacular English fuels another billion-dollar industry called hip-hop? Come on. So we're the only enslaved people in history from Brazil to the United States whose culture enslaved the people who enslaved them. And by their choice, just put the handcuffs on us. So we showed up here empty-handed, but we didn't show up here empty-headed. That's what we tell our children. That's the phrase to remember. So when I do my cooking is based on how do you distinguish yourself as a culinary presence, as a chef? Every chef now thinks they're a culinary historian. Yeah, you got to write papers, you got to write books, you got to go to stuffy places like Oxford, like I have, and get up in front of a bunch of people who are also stuffy and make them laugh, which is even harder. Or try to make an audience of ethnobotanists laugh. That's hard. But I've done that. I worked that crowd. I mean, Linnaeus was in the back going, "You go, boy." There's some people who know who Linnaeus is in the room. I'm impressed. So, for me, it was all about figuring out what are the categories of food? Why don't I source this stuff? You know, I like to tell you I made mistakes. I like to tell you I was wrong. I like to tell you that I love making mistakes because making mistakes enables you to learn the right path to go. So at first, it was all plastic and modern stuff. And then it was, you know, reenact to get after you. No, you got to have the wooden stuff and you got to have the real stuff. Okay, fine. And then you look at the sticker price. Like, okay, really? So you, then you're all like, I'm going to learn how to cook everything in a Dutch oven. I ain't spending this money again. And the Dutch oven, that's going to have to work for everything. So the next thing comes, well, you have to eat the right produce. You can't just roll up to, you know, Kroger and get a Jersey tomato and call yourself, okay, fine. So I started growing the appropriate heirloom produce and learning more. And I started seeking out people like William Boyes Weaver, Peter Hatch, all the folks who were doing historic gardening, who had been doing this for 30, 40 years at Williamsburg, Monticello, Philadelphia, etc. Asking them, what plants have African-American stories? I also went to African food shops, and I was looking for any viable seeds. So you know there's a lot of dried produce, like black-eyed peas, like goosey seeds, like okra. So I figured if it's a dried seed and it's whole, it'll grow. So I started growing those. So then it was all about sourcing everything, figuring out where everything was. And then I had to relearn the parts of animals, like biology class. Then I had to relearn the parts of plants, like botany class. And then I had someone who was very condescending and microaggressively racist come up to me and challenge me on something, and then I decided to go home and pull a Malcolm X and learn every single botanical, zoological name by heart. I mean, like 300 of these things. And I would just sit there with an attitude. Remember that scene where Julia Child was chopping up all them onions? Her husband walked in, he started looking at her, and I thought, I better back out this kitchen. That's how I was. Because, you know, I understood, and I'm glad I got that slap in the face early, because it made me strong. Because I began to understand, you know, when you're going to do this work, you got to come correct. You got to be twice as good to be just as good. And that's just the way it is. You have to know every scientific name. You have to be able to hold your own with that forensic anthropologist, that ethnobotanist. You have to be the best, because your ancestors are counting on you, and our children are counting on you double. That does not mean I don't make mistakes, and I love making mistakes. I love failing, because it gives me a better path. But it does mean that I'm serious about this. I don't work with probable. I don't work with maybe. I don't work with fake lore. I don't work with food lore. I work with the truth. And that's all you can do. So when I show you these collard greens, yes, those are collards. Those are called green glaze. And they can be as small as that, or they can be huge. Those are turnip greens that you grow in the field after you've grown tobacco. And all that's from the York River, the crabs, the oysters, and the croaker. So you have to be at one with nature. You have to understand how these things came out of the environment, how people treated them, how people saw them. We think of food as a means to an end, because I'm hungry and I want this or that. You know, there were certain things that you just didn't do. Benjamin Latrobe, the famous architect, is walking along the James River, and he sees an elderly black man fishing in Virginia, and he goes, forgive me, hey, uncle, what are you doing? He says, Master, I'm fishing. He says, are you catching shad? And he said, no, I wouldn't serve shad to a witch's dog. So this idea that everybody eats, the ancestors ate any old thing because they were hungry, is nonsense. They picked and choose what they were going to eat and not eat the same way we do. Some love shad, some did not. That story illustrates for you that they had their preferences. They had seasonal. You have to understand the seasons. You know, to us, you can get anything you want anytime, virtually. They couldn't. So there was a time for croaker. There was a crab time. There was an oyster time. There was a shad time, a herring time. When the fish came, when the anadromous species like herring and shad and rockfish come up the rivers in the spring, you knew it was that time. And basically, that fish got turned into saltfish. You know, you got your 2 gallons of pork. 2 gallons of corn, unbolted corn, which you had to process yourself into hominy, into cornmeal, whatever it was. And by process, I mean that a woman in the community, enslaved community, or two, used a standing mortar and pestle and processed that corn. You might have gotten a little bit of pork, but that pork thing really doesn't amp up till the 19th century. In the Chesapeake, it's saltfish. In the Low Country, you got whatever they're going to give you. Or you went out and caught and hunted for yourself. And all of this is using skills, knowledge, and abilities brought from West Africa. So when I was in Ghana, and they had this groundhog-looking thing called a cutting grass rat, and it's everywhere, and it's smoked, it's fresh, it's dried, it's this, and it is the biggest pizza rat-looking thing you ever saw in your life. I watched the whole process, and unlike the rest of the chefs on my visit, I decided I was not going to eat the cutting grass rat. Even though the sauce smelled pretty good, I was like, I ain't going out like this. So, always, all due respect to Miss Mabel, her cutting grass didn't kill anybody, but it didn't kill me that day either. But yeah. But it made me understand possum and sweet potatoes a lot better. You feel me? It made me understand, you know, where are my guys? The four food groups. Y'all Kentucky people, don't about the four food groups. We ain't gonna go there tonight. But you know, you understand that all these guys have different seasons. And it's free food, right? Because especially rabbit. You know, we made rabbit burger for Andrew Zimmerman earlier this week. You know, he loved it. You know, this is stuff. And it's all these animals are also trappable. You're enslaved. There are laws about you carrying a gun. So you wonder why certain animals make it into the archaeological record and others don't. It's because some of them, like deer, you can't just, it's not easy to just snare and trap a deer. Deer are mostly, who does that? Enslaved people living on plantations in the rice country, where one enslaved man is trusted with a gun to shoot the rice birds and shoot the deer that go into the field to eat the crop. And then magically, that deer and that rice bird appear in the cabin remains all along the low country. Same thing in Louisiana. But here, you know, every once in a while, you might have that situation. Or I like to talk about the malatitis. Y'all know about the malatitis? The malatitis is an incredible disease. You know, you have some hogs, right? And hogs are the most likely to get the malatitis. So you have, you know, hogs run around. It wasn't like, you know, old McDonald had a farm. Yeah, that's nonsense. In the South, hogs ran around wild until they were collected. And they had an earmark, hint, hint. And that earmark told you whose hog was what. So on occasion, a hog that was rooting outside in the Oak Hickory Forest would get the malatitis. And so an enslaved person come in and say, you know, we had a hog that's got the malatitis. And well, what's wrong with it? Well, it just can't see right. Its eyes are going all over the place. It just looks crazy. Well, get rid of it. It's going to make other hogs sick. Okay. And so what he doesn't know, what the buckwheat don't know, is that the malatitis is the action of taking a heavy mallet and knocking the hog out. And then the hog that had the malatitis then becomes the property of the enslaved community. And that's how barbecue was born. Now, but you know, these are ingenious people. Because that story isn't about being tricky. The story is about survival. And it's also about redistributing more fairly the material culture of that world. Because what would it be like for you if you, you know, you're in this kitchen, right? Hold on, we gotta go back to the kitchen. We gotta go back to it. You're in this kitchen all day long, you're making this fancy food. There are two people, two Randolph family members in that big house, and you in that little space, and there's 27 enslaved people. And you never get to touch that food because it's not your food. How would you feel? How would that resonate with you? So it's really important to talk about the power structure. You know, people all the time talk about, well, isn't the slave food, and first of all, we say enslaved, because slave is an identity, enslaved is a condition, get it right. Enslaved people's food and free people of color's food is different from white folks' food because we didn't have all the power and access So it's not fair to say, isn't it all the same food anyway? Because that's a way of obfuscating and obscuring and making invisible the presence and agency of enslaved people. It's a really good way of saying, I don't want to hear about your mess, your stuff, your baggage, and especially your African identity, because I don't understand it, I don't know about it. You know, that's pretty much how I got started. People would say words to me like, oh, we don't know much about Africa, there's not much documentation, so, oh, it's a shame. And I'm like, okay, challenge accepted. You know, now we're going to do this. We're going to do this. So I want to, let's quickly go through a couple things. I want to read every one of these things through the perspective of what I've seen in West Africa. So this guy right here, he gets called, what do most Southerners call that? It's not a, just a terrapin. What's another word in the South for that? Begins with a C. Cooter. Two sources. Nkuta from Congo means a tortoise. Nkuta from Manding means a turtle. And so that becomes part of the language of every Southerner. Shad. You, if West Africans look at that and say, oh, that's bonga shad. That's the fish that comes in and comes along the coast and spawns. Well, it's same family, different species. Same genus, different species. Oysters, if you're in Senegal and Gambia and you're in the mangroves, you're going to see those and they're going to eat them. Same thing with crabs. You can, in West Africa, there are freshwater crabs and there are ocean crabs. And the ocean crabs are pretty much the tropical version of the blue crabs we have on this side of the ocean. So just going and seeing the market and going, okay, this looks familiar, that looks familiar. Here we go, watermelon. That's an heirloom variety, watermelon, and right beside it, a hot pepper. So watermelon is indigenous to southern Africa, spreads across sub-Saharan Africa. So watermelon and muskmelon, what you call a cantaloupe, are both African domesticates. Crops like tomatoes, peanuts, peppers, corn, etc., sweet potatoes, cassava, go eastward to the continent via the Spanish and Portuguese, but the Spanish and Portuguese aren't the ones effectively teaching people how to grow them. More interesting to me is that there are some native people who go from Brazil to Angola, and because of that, that's how they learn how to process cassava. But the bottom line is that those crops go over and they become Africanized, the same way that bananas and plantains had long ago come from Southeast Asia and India to Africa. And over the course of 2,000 years, experienced more botanical diversity under the hands of African cultivators than they did in their homelands. So there are bananas and plantains that you serve to dogs. They're ones you make for beer. There's just that many. And they're across the entire continent. There's some that you grow just to eat the pith of the plant. That's more valuable than the fruit. So all that has to be taken into consideration. These are master cultivators. Why would you go to Africa and get a bunch of know-nothings? Like I was told in elementary school, oh, your ancestors were unskilled laborers from the rainforest of West Africa. Again, give me a challenge, I'll take it. So these become our ancestors' new yams. Those were from the Guinea coast. And when I say our ancestors, the reason why I took the time in the cooking gene to go through genetic tests and all of that was because, when fortunately in our scholarship, we have all these different disciplines operating as if they're the only discipline, not working together. Archaeology and gastronomy and food history and culinary history and architectural material culture history and botany, about, you get the point. And they don't work together. They work together, right? And so for me, historiography was telling me that certain groups of enslaved people went to certain places. Okay. And also, we're also saying the word African without identifying what Africans. So for me to be able to go into my own body and find the evidence that, oh yeah, my Virginia ancestors were most certainly what the historiography tells us they were. They were Eastern Nigerians. My South Carolina ancestors were most certainly from Sierra Leone and from Congo. My ancestors from in between, from every Madagascar, They were from Ghana. They were from here. They were from there. And not just some random pie chart. I've actually been able to make contact with people who share significant DNA material with me, my grandfather, my father, my uncle, and say, hey, what's up? You know, tell me more about who we are. My name ain't no Twitty. My name is Njai. I come from the Lion Clan of the Sarah. Twitty was a name was given to us at the last second before the Civil War. My name ain't no Twitty. My name is Njai. And not only is it Njai, but it's Jetta, which is a Mandaing version. They both mean the Lion Clan. So I'm cool with that. I know what my name was. I didn't have to look in a book and it'll dream it up. I know what it is. And that's hard work. That's 40 years of dreaming, 5 years of thousands of dollars I didn't have. That's a lot of ramen. But it was worth it because I can tell you who I am. That's our biggest problem. A lot of us don't know where we are, who our names are, and where we come from. And that's what fits in with food because people all the time talk about, I remember when I first brought this book out, people were like, well, look, that's nice and all, but, you know, sometimes your heritage is detrimental. And I said, oh, that's a lovely game we get brought on us. People try to make our heritage into a pathology. Blackness is not a pathology. Black culture is not a pathology. African culture is not a pathology. So when I talk about our heritage, I'm talking about of the 10 healthiest diets on the planet, 8 of them are from African, West African nations. Not African, West African nations, where our people came from. So we have to ask the question, what happened between that ocean coast and this coast that changed everything up? So yes, it's important for us to understand ourselves on that genetic microbiological level because it's a lifesaver and it's also a mind saver and a spirit saver. Health is not just what you do with your body, what you do with your mind and your spirit as well. You know, you can't chase other people's stuff and call yourself knowing who you are. So that okra, okuru from Ibaland, that sweet potato pumpkin which came from Native Americans over to the Caribbean, up to the south. When people, Southerners talked about a pumpkin, they didn't talk about their orange number. That's what they meant. And it's from the enslaved peoples from the West Indies. Our food, every Southerner is about hot sauce and spices, thank God. If y'all were just British, where's your Yorkshire pudding and roast beef? Where's your roast Sunday dinner? Or your jellied eels? Come on now. I've been in Nigeria and I've been to England. You white Southerners in the room have a lot more in common with them Nigerians than you do with those English people. You know, that's the way it goes. Our friends again. But I just want you to think about what it takes to make these things happen. What it took for someone to get up 4 o'clock in the morning, get breakfast on the table by 8, already started the makings for dinner. Dinner is at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. You don't have a life. But you're giving your culture, your jambalaya, your barbecue, your fried chicken, your okra soup, your okra with rice called Limpin' Susan, your black-eyed peas with rice called Hoppin' John, your watermelon, your muskmelon, your cola. Everybody in this room done had a cola. Well, the night ago, that wasn't true. Thank you for proving me wrong. Everybody in this room has had coffee from Ethiopia. Which originated in Ethiopia. It's like the influence of Africa is all around us. The spiritual influence of Africa is all around us. It's not a white preacher on TV, they don't preach black now. Even Joel Osteen with his mullet. I'm mad at Joel. You know, he's friends with Tyler Perry, it's all good. But this is the work that we, that's my friend, Harold, my brother for life, Harold. We went to Africa together. It was a good experience. But it's all about teaching people about these different tools and how they work, how they differ from century to century. And so in learning all these different pieces of the story, and that's pokeweed, you got it right, in learning different parts of the story, we're able to transfer the next generation where we come from. People ask me all the time, are you a chef? And I said, yes, but I'm not a chef that works online. I'm a chef that represents this tradition. If this tradition was good enough to make Thomas Jefferson's table the stuff, because it wasn't Thomas Jefferson cooking the food, who was it? James Hemings. It wasn't George Washington, it was Hercules. It was men and women across the South who brought their African culture with them, who blackified it all and made it taste better. So at that point, I'm gonna leave it for questions. Questions, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. So the power object that I wear around my neck is called many different things. People used to call it as a feather bag. They call it a mojo packet. They used to call it a hand. And in that particular, I have different ones across my life, and they contain different things. And usually when you do this work, you sweat a lot, and other stuff happens, and the leather contracts, and you kind of, like, become an artifact. And you fill them up with stuff. And it's like, okay, this one's done. I'm going to save it and then want the next one. So this one in particular has something very special in it. And that particular power object sack that I have, I was on a plantation in South Carolina doing a pilot for Vice. And one of the directors of the museum down there in Middleton Place said to me, you know, it's been raining lately in the area where the enslaved people's quarter was. We keep, where the cabins were, we keep getting little pieces of the pottery they were that they ate from. And so he gave me, it was some of the cast-off pottery from the big house, but it was the plate our ancestors ate from. So when I carry that around my neck, I know who I'm working for. My ancestors are the board of directors. So I always know who I'm working for when I have that little piece of pottery. And every now and then I'll take it out and look at it and touch it and be like, you know what? Somebody cares. Somebody's working for you. Somebody wants you to know that you're still important to us. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And even though they, let's say, perhaps many of them encountered Christianity when they arrived, that didn't totally overwhelm African religious sensibilities.
Absolutely.
Right? So I'm wondering if any of that showed up in the kitchen, you know, if there were any ideas or attitudes that shaped the way they prepared the food or the way that they did things in the kitchen. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, for example, when we were in Mobile, I met a chef named Chef Vincent Henderson. He was like one of the old school Creole cooks. You know, Mobile and New Orleans have a thing with each other. You know, who's on first? The best way to describe it. We had the first Mardi Gras. No, we had the first Mardi Gras. No. You know, all that nonsense. Our gumbo's better. Our gumbo's better. But Chef came from, you know, one of the things about him was, you see this very light-skinned man of African descent with clear gray eyes, straight hair, and the first words out of his mouth were, I'm Chef Vincent Henderson, I may not look black, but I am. And in true Creole fashion, here's my family tree. I'm a 10th generation Mobilian. You know, and so we talked about gumbo. And everybody thinks, you know, these things are you know, formulas. Mm-mm. There's a gumbo for this season, a gumbo for that season. There's a gumbo you serve at a wedding, a gumbo you serve at a funeral. And the gumbo has an architecture, and it starts this way. You have to build it. And then he said, there's gumbo for different holidays. And then he says the words, if you're one of the Vodouns, and this is not a conversation you don't usually have with outsiders, you know what I'm saying? He says, whatever spirit you serve has a different gumbo. So this comes down into the culture. It's kind of like when Americans heard Desi Arnaz and his son sing Babalu and didn't understand they were singing to a Yoruba deity, an Orisha. And they thought it was some nonsense, whatever. How much of our culture is, you know, was brought down to the present as nonsense, as babble, as baby talk? And it actually wasn't. So those black-eyed peas on that table have an incredible story. Because on the one hand, everybody in this room says, when do you eat black-eyed peas? Mm-hmm. And why do you eat them? Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the other part of the car? So you eat the collard greens for what? Money. And you eat the black eyed peas for what? Change. And that word has a pun, right? Change. Both coins and shift in your luck. In Yoruba, I'm proud to say I'm a Yoruba descendant. That's a big one. I think I was real. That one got me. I was like, okay. So when I say Ashe and all that stuff, I'm talking my ancestors' language. When I went to Howard University, I chose to learn not Spanish, not French, not continue with those. I chose to learn Yoruba for 2 years. And then I'm looked back 20-some years later going, whoa. I'm like, more than one line Yoruba. It's like, okay. They're real. They're here. They're with us. So in Yoruba, the word for black-eyed peas, because Yoruba is tonal, E-W-A, E-W-A, means black-eyed peas. Change the tone, it means beauty. Change the tone, it means tradition. And it's a fertility food because it's associated with Oshun, the Orisha of love and romance. In Senegal, it's associated with the eye of Allah. Always open, never changing. And then when you're experiencing misfortune, you have to go make a pot of niebe, which they always eat with rice. Jabu niebe is the same thing as Hop and John. And jambalaya congri in the old New Orleans. And so you serve that to somebody who is poor, but you don't just give it to them and throw it away. You actually have to like have a conversation and feed them and treat them like a human being. And only when that pot is empty can you go back to the imam or the traditional healer and go, can I have a blessing? So there's values in our food. And the food was also medicinal. There's a lot of things we've forgotten, but there's also a lot of things we remembered. One of the things that got to me long after the book was finished, I learned this and it flipped me out while I was in Ghana. Because everybody thinks it's only a female story. It's only a woman's story. And I keep telling people that slavery was colloquial and discretionary. Not one narrative does not fit all. And furthermore, gender roles often shifted from Africa to America via enslavement. So in Africa, men are the tailors, are the seamsters. Men make the clothing. Women spin, but men weave. In America, women were the spinners and the weavers and the seamstresses. In West Africa, I thought men don't cook except for when they do the ceremonial cooking. How wrong was I? Again, remember I told you, I like to be wrong. When I was in Ghana, and I'm a good 30-some percent of my African DNA is from Ghana, I learned that I'm on the Ashanti, and I'm Ashanti. I went to the former palace of the Ashanti king, the Asantehene, and they told me, this made me cry. In a very happy, sweet way. And Harold was there with me, and we said, the guide told us, yo, you guys are cooks. What do you cook for? We laughed. We said, we cook for the Abroni. Abroni means white people in America at this museum. What kind of, and said the head man. And they said, of course you're Ghanaian. Because the Ashanti king, all his cooks were men. And they were the ones, when they brought people into slavery, they tried to capture people who supported you. One of the most important people in the king's retinue were his cooks. Somebody's telling you where you come from, who you are, who is in your lineage, what you're about. Now, I'm going to clean this up because we have younger ears in the audience. But there's a reason why the cooks were only men. Think about it. Black folks, you know the reason why. Remember that thing that your grandparents used to do, and maybe your parents, but my grandparents never did, and their grandparents before them? The women didn't cook all the time. I'm blinking at you. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Sydney, you, yes, you do. We're going to talk about it after the fact, sister. And it was because it was associated, one of the things about having multiple wives, polygamous culture, is the idea that the women will take turns putting a hex on you. So, yes, that whole thing. And it's not uncommon. It's in Jewish culture as well. So it's like, that's why the royal cooks were men. For a lot of these roles, I was like blown away. Absolutely blown away. Yes?
I'm interested in how this transformed, if at all, after emancipation to the children and grandchildren of the enslaved when they were hired as domestics for the Nouveau Riche.
Mm-hmm. So this lasts, it lasts about a generation more. Here's the interesting thing. Around 1750, things start to change. We actually see that kind of like the birth of soul food, because this is by now, it's in the upper Chesapeake and New England and the Mid-Atlantic, above it, almost everybody is spoken for. We have a majority-born American population, which trickles from Africa, okay? And then from 1750 to 1770, you can get your last groups of Africans coming to Chesapeake. However, in the South Carolina, it's going to be through to the beginning of the 19th century. My DNA profile proves that. There are people, my grandfather, I found my grandfather's fourth cousin who's full-blooded Congolese. So that means they're coming really late. Point being is that 1750, majority American born. We're like every other American immigrant population, although we were forced migrants. The bottom line is the grandparents and the parents were in a predominantly African conceptual and material world. Their children, who are now born over here, have none of that. So two, three generations in. Then, after the Civil War, the difference is now you have a lot of cooks packed up, said, bye, I'm out of here. Others could not afford to do so and stayed, or went to cities and became cooks. And majority restaurants were majority African-American cooks, male and female. But you still have the problem of literacy. In the South, the modernity of the kitchen took a long time. They didn't have the wood stove overnight. That, in most Southern homes, that wood stove didn't even happen until 1900. After that time period, people were still working with that hearth because that's all they had. And family also, those wealthy plantation families, they couldn't recoup to do stuff. And if you had a cook that was still living from slavery times, they weren't going to cook on the wood stove anyway. They cooked with what they knew. So that shift, so then we have the era of, remember, around 1820 or so, through the Civil War, we have Virginia housewife, Kentucky housewife, Carolina housewife, they're always housewives, the original housewives. And these are white women who are writing recipes that, yes, some of which come from Europe, but a lot come from the African tradition. A lot come from the enslaved who are filtering European, Native American, African, and Asian influence in their cooking. But they get the credit. The women who work for them didn't. So by the next wave, we have the women who were born during the war, saw the war and Reconstruction, who are now writing about the faithful servant. And they, to the point where they almost erected a Mammy monument, I'm not making this up, on the National Mall. Wow, I'm glad that one didn't work out. Seriously. To talk about not only the delicious cooking, but the faithful Negro of ages past. This is a real thing. I'm not Snopes this one. It ain't a lie. So there was a progression. So this is a great place to conclude our talk, because it also engages us. Everybody, every couple of months, an article comes out talking about where are all the black chefs. Well, Jacques Pepin, Pierre Frenet, Julia Child knew where the black chefs were in their time. They were the ones cooking at all the restaurants. You know, Peter Luger, Delmonico's, you know, all those. Edna Lewis, come on now. All those restaurants, the staff was black. In the same way that in many restaurants, the staff was Latinx. So you didn't have to ask. The problem was, when civil rights comes, we began to disassociate from the kitchen because it was beneath us. Even though those were state stable, almost hereditary jobs. You could